Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, as the housing market rebounds, have the rules of real estate changed? The CEO of the website Zillow says yes, he will join us.
But first, to Mexico today, where officials have declared 43 missing college students dead. This comes 4 months after their abduction shook the nation. That set off an investigation that eventually uncovered connections among the local government, police, and a local drug gang. Brendan Case is covering this story. He joins us from the offices of Bloomberg News in Mexico City. Brendan, would you remind us first of the event itself and the students who were abducted?
Yes, Lisa, there were 43 students from a rural teachers' college who went missing after clashes with police in the southern town of Iguala. This was on September 26th. Since then, they have been missing, and their case has sparked protest after protest. It's come to symbolize just the lack of rule of law and the danger that the drug war has created for people around Mexico. One of the students has been identified as having died, by the government. The other ones remain missing, but yesterday the attorney general said that evidence proves that they were killed.
And what was the evidence that the attorney general was talking about?
Confessions by alleged killers of the students was one of the top pieces of evidence that he had. The government arrested the head of the hitmen for the so-called Guerreros Unidos, or United Warriors gang, I should say the alleged head of hitmen, who admitted, according to the government, that he had ordered that the students be killed, and three accomplices allegedly also confessed to actually killing the students and burning their bodies and then throwing the remains in the river in bags.
But then what's the nature of this alleged cooperation among this drug gang and local police and government? How does that figure in?
According to the attorney general, local police in Iguala took the students hostage, seized them, worked with police in the nearby town of Kukula to deliver the students to members of this drug gang, who were the ones who then killed them, according to the allegation by the government.
And what was the impetus? What's the government saying about that?
What the attorney general said yesterday is that the Guerreros Unidos gang thought that there were members of a rival crime group infiltrated in the students. The attorney general said that he did not have evidence that that was the case, but did have evidence that that's what the crime gang members believed to be the case.
Parents of these students are responding and responding with full voice. They had their own press conference last night. What did they say?
They don't believe the government's version and point out that of the 43 students who are missing, only one has been identified through DNA by the government, and the lack of identification or bodies that have been found of the others have created a lot of skepticism about whether the government's version is accurate. At the same time, the parents and other relatives of the students are demanding access to army bases, including one that's in Iguala, to try to learn what, if any, was the role of the military in these incidents. The attorney general says that he has no evidence at all that there was any army involvement.
So it sounds like the government in its own press conference was trying to basically close this case. It also sounds like the case is far from closed. What is expected to happen next?
From the government's view, that's correct. I mean, the attorney general said explicitly that he wasn't technically closing the case, but he also said that he believed that the evidence proved beyond doubt that that his version of what happened to the students is, in fact, what happened. There are some extra arrest warrants the government wants to execute, but for all intents and purposes, the government investigation is essentially completed, and the case will now go to the courts. Whether the parents of the students and whether Mexican society at large believes that version is very much an open question. There have been protests throughout the last few months, including one this week, and there's a general expectation that those protests are likely to continue.
Okay. Thank you, Brendan Case, reporting from the offices of Bloomberg News in Mexico City. Thanks a lot, Brendan.
Thanks.
Well, here in the U.S., home prices are still on the rise. According to a report this week from S&P Case-Shiller, prices rose 4.7% in the 12 months that ended in November. And if you want to see what's happening to your home value, you might go to the website Zillow. Since it was founded in 2005, it has changed the real estate industry, and its CEO, Spencer Raskoff, has just written a book about it, along with the company's chief economist, Stan Humphries. It's called Zillow Talk, The New Rules of Real Estate. And as we continue our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top, we're joined now by Spencer Raskoff and Stan Humphries. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, and you write, Spencer, that you created Zillow to turn on the lights and bring transparency to one of our country's most opaque industries. And part of the way that you do that is by providing consumers with this thing that is called a Zestimate. It's an estimate of the value of almost every home in America. How do you get that number? How do you find that Zestimate?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. It's probably what Zillow is best known for. Something like 80% of all homes in America have been Zillowed, have actually had the owner look up their Zestimate on the site. The way we calculate the Zestimate is a very complex algorithm, which Dr. Stan here can explain. But the shorthand is we look at the properties of the subject home and we compare it with like properties. But we do it using machine learning and algorithms, which are very complex. We value every home in the country every night. And nationwide, Zestimates are actually quite accurate, even though they're computer-generated.
How accurate are they?
Well, right now, we religiously update our accuracy on our website. And for the past 3 months, our accuracy was 8% median absolute percent error, which is about twice as good as when we started in 2006, when our accuracy was about 14%. About 85% of Zestimates are within 20% of the selling price, and close to 40% are within 5%.
Although there are a lot of critics, including a real estate agent who wrote in the Washington Post that Zestimates are within 5% of the actual value of the home only half the time, and that if a real estate agent had that record, he'd be out of business. And he complains that a lot of these clients that he has cling to the Zestimate as if it's the official appraisal. I'm sure you've heard that criticism. How do you respond to it?
Well, you know, we call it a Zestimate, not as appraisal. It's supposed to be a starting point to figure out a home's value. If you want a more accurate opinion of your value, you should consult an appraiser or a real estate agent. Zillow provides all this great free information for consumers as a starting point, and the consumer is undoubtedly much more empowered today than 10 years ago before we started, and we think that's very important.
Well, I found one of the interesting things in the book is that you say that you don't think Zillow is going to replace the traditional appraiser. Why is that?
Because real estate is such a personal and expensive and infrequent and emotional transaction, there will always be a professional, an intermediary in the transaction. Now, the role of that professional has changed radically because of the internet and because of Zillow. It used to be, before Zillow came along, that the role of that real estate agent was to provide access to the consumer to that secret database of information. Well, now that secret database is online. It's on your smartphone. It's on your tablet. It's on Zillow. And so the consumer has the same information as the professional, but the consumer still needs the professional's help to help them interpret it. So the real estate agent's role has changed, but their importance has not been diminished.
And you don't think that as data gets even better and your algorithms get even better over time, you won't eventually someday replace the appraiser?
I don't think so. You know, we look at it a lot like healthcare, where a patient nowadays takes control of their health situation. They research online their disease, their drugs, the side effects, et cetera, but they still go to the doctor to help them interpret the information. And that's the way we see real estate going because it's so infrequent and expensive.
I want to ask you a question that many Americans, maybe every American has, which is whether to buy or to rent. And you write that it really depends on where you are. Stan, can you talk about that? How do you decide whether you should be buying or renting the property that you're in or that you want?
Well, we think that, you know, it's a complicated issue because there's certainly a lot of things that go into, you know, buying and renting, where you think about buying, certainly there are tax benefits, you know, a variety of different costs that go along with home ownership. And then on the renting side, it's a little bit more straightforward, but you've got obviously expectations about what rent prices are going to do in the future, you know, renter's insurance, things like that. But we kind of boiled all that down, and we think the easiest way that we've come up with to kind of think about that is what we call this break-even horizon, which is this notion of how long do you have to live in a house to make buying more advantageous than renting? Because, you know, I think everyone understands that if you're going to be in a house for 20, 30 years, you should probably buy the house. And if you're going to be in the house for 6 months, you should rent it. What people don't know is kind of where do those two lines cross? And it turns out that it varies in time and in space when those lines cross. So using our big database at Zillow, we crunch those numbers every quarter and compute the break-even horizon, how long you have to live in a house to make buying more advantageous than renting for every city and metro across the country. And what we found was that in most metros right now, the break-even horizon is substantially less than 3 years. And in fact, nationally, it's only 2.3 years.
But of course, there are some cities where it's more than that and some cities where the average is less than that. You compare buying a home and the prices, the home values that we've seen in this country to, for example, the stock market, which brings me to another question. Is a home, do you think, an investment or is it a place that you live?
Well, we think the housing market works best when people think of it not as an investment, so not as a speculative asset, but rather as a utility that you're going to consume. So, you know, I guess we get concerned when home prices appreciate at 12% a year and then the next year they fall 15. That's clearly behavior that is being fueled by people who are thinking of it as a speculative asset. And home prices work best when housing markets are boring and they appreciate 3.5% a year. And what they're really buying it for is it's a convenient way to consume the utility of putting a roof over your head. And if you think about it like that, then we think people end up making smarter decisions versus thinking, you know, getting caught up in hysterias like we had in the height of the last housing cycle, where people think the default decision should always be to buy a home, and they kind of threw everything else out the window, like how long you're going to be in the house, whether home prices might be, you know, a little bit rich relative to historical norms or anything else.
If you're just joining us, we've been talking with Zillow CEO Spencer Raskoff and the company's chief economist, Stan Humphries, about their new book called Zillow Talk, The New Rules of Real Estate. And Spencer, one thing you talk about in the book that I want to ask about is how do you predict, as you look at your data, what the next hot neighborhood is going to be?
We analyzed a lot of different neighborhoods and looked at different housing cycles around the country. And historically, it's actually been quite easy to figure out what the next hot neighborhood was going to be. It's to actually look at where the gay population lives in a given city. And one of the reasons for that is that historically speaking, gays have been priced out of the most expensive parts of the city. And so they move into a different part of the city, which quickly gentrifies and becomes hip and cool and then becomes very expensive pretty rapidly. However, now that gays are much more part of the social mainstream of our country, you can't follow that rule of thumb anymore. And so you have to look for other populations, the hipsters, if you will, the cool kids, and figure out where they're living. But one of the things that we analyzed in Zillow Talk is, although you might think you do best when you buy into one of those hot neighborhoods, you actually don't, because by the time you realize that a neighborhood is hot, it's already happened. And so you'd be better off buying the next closest neighborhood. Those homes are going to appreciate faster than the hot neighborhood. So the misnomer is location, location, location. It's really not the current location. It's what will the location be in 5 or 10 years? And the answer is probably whatever's closest to what's hot today.
You also look at the proximity of Starbucks to where the house is, and that actually makes a very big difference in the value, the potential value of your home.
It does. You know, this is something that was a lot of fun to analyze in the book. So we looked at 17 years worth of data and looked at every Starbucks in the country and every home within a quarter mile of that Starbucks. And homes within a quarter mile of a Starbucks appreciated 96% over those 17 years. If you were within a quarter mile of a Dunkin' Donuts, your home appreciated 80% during that time period.
Also, is that, though, just because of where those companies are putting their businesses? Or is it, like, was the neighborhood there first and they just found a good place to put it? Or is it that people want to live close to a Starbucks?
Yeah, we were interested in that, too, because obviously it is a little bit of a question of, you know, is it that the neighborhood was appreciating quickly in terms of home values, and that's why they decided to put the Starbucks there? What we did actually were able to do with the Starbucks specifically was leverage some data that had been collected by this really kind of Starbucks super fan who had basically compiled a list of every single Starbucks in the world and the latitude and longitude of that Starbucks and then when it opened. And knowing that open date was really important because it then allowed us to do an econometric analysis where we controlled for the prior trajectory of home values in that Starbucks area and then look at what happened in the first 5 years after the Starbucks opened, and did home values increase the pace or decrease the pace? And what we found was that doing an analysis that way, the effect is a little bit less than the 17-year analysis that Spencer described, but there's still a strong effect of living closer to Starbucks. Your home values do appreciate after that Starbucks opens up. So
and
it's
then
not,
you can afford the coffees that they have at Starbucks.
that's exactly right.
Now, you also talk about renovating your house and remodeling and doing work to upgrade it and whether that's actually worth it. I didn't realize that a kitchen remodel is really not a good idea if you want to try to recoup that money when you sell.
I think that chapter is so emblematic of everything else we tried to do with the book, which was, you know, we have these unexamined assumptions that we just carry around in our heads about real estate and have never asked, you know, where's that data come from? Because it's like each year I see some survey of people about what's going to be the biggest, you know, bang for your buck in a remodel. And it's always kitchen remodel, but it's always a survey. It was never empirical data. So what we did was we leveraged the information about thousands of homeowners who have claimed homes on Zillow and told us about their upgrades. And then subsequently we saw a sale on that house. And we were able to use that data to tease out the impact of that upgrade they told us about. And what we found was that actually kitchen remodel wasn't the biggest bang for the buck. Instead, it was a bathroom remodel. So adding some functionality to the house of a working toilet was actually much more valuable in the resale than upgrading your kitchen.
In particular, a lower-end bathroom remodel because it doesn't have to be gorgeous. And people frequently overbuild on these remodeling projects hoping that they'll get the money out on the other end, and they usually don't.
Why do you think that is, that the kitchen is not as important?
Because buyers have very specific tastes. And so if you remodel your kitchen in a very high-end way and the backsplash that you choose and the tile and the materials on the kitchen island are in a particular way that you really loved, that may or may not meet the needs and the tastes of a particular buyer. Whereas just having another functional bathroom, you know, everybody's going to be okay with that.
I remember my parents telling me that the house that they brought me up in as a kid, that when they bought it, it had been painted on the inside red and black because the previous owner was a doctor and wanted the house to look like the inside of a body or something like that. Needless to say, that was changed. I want to talk to you about some of the words that are used in listings, because this was an interesting part of the book as well, that if a house is described as unique, it's not going to do well.
Yeah, that's right. Unique is something that clearly the current owner liked, but it means that unique should be a signal that it's more of a niche property, and it's probably not going to return as much as it would otherwise. In fact, we found that if you use unique in your listing description, it's likely to sell for 30 to 50% less than it would otherwise.
Wow.
Other words to avoid are nice, charming, cute. These are all kind of throwaway words that sellers or their listing agent, when they don't have anything real to describe about the functionality of the home, they use these throwaway words. And on the other hand, good words to use are things like luxurious, landscaped, captivating, and then describing the specific features of the home is also very helpful.
I want to do a quick lightning round before I let both of you go. Just short answers to these questions, and I'll go to each of you for each of them. But let's start with you, Spencer. What is your near-term prediction for the American real estate market?
Up 3% over the next 12 months. Slow and steady, pretty boring, which is good.
Stan?
Same prediction for home prices, 3%. Healing, slowly getting back to normal, but still pretty far off from normal.
Stan, what do you think the hottest real estate market in the U.S. is right now?
San Francisco.
Spencer?
Manhattan.
And the worst?
Probably Akron.
Poor old Akron.
Poor old Akron.
Are you guys in agreement
Midwest.
On Akron?
I'll defer to Stan.
Okay. And what did you each learn from the huge collapse in housing that happened shortly after Zillow really became a function of the American real estate industry? And I'll start with you, Spencer.
I learned that I wish this type of information that Zillow puts on the web and on smartphones, I wish it existed during the 2005, 2006, 2007 run-up, because a lot of the pain to our economy and to our country and, frankly, to the world could have been avoided if people had access to more information, if they could have tracked and followed what was happening on the way up. Hopefully, we would have been smarter and more informed.
I was really struck by during the housing downturn when we would publish reports on various things about mortgages or negative equity or home prices, and we would get calls from major banks, private equity firms, the Federal Reserve,
government,
and say, hey, can you, we would love to find out more about this. And I'm like, well, you know, I would assume you guys already had all this stuff. And they're like, no, we don't have anything like this. So I was really struck by even these people who you would think would have their finger on, you know, the minute pulse of what's happening in the housing market, just had no real intelligence about the details, and not because of their own lack of attention to that, just it wasn't available.
Is wallpaper ever going to come back?
Everything eventually. If you wait long enough, everything comes back.
But you're not seeing it in the listings now. That's not a successful term. House filled with wallpaper?
No, we haven't seen that in the data yet. But wait long enough. It'll come back, I'm sure.
Spencer Raskoff, the CEO of Zillow. Stan Humphries is the chief economist. Their new book is called Zillow Talk, The New Rules of Real Estate. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy.
Outdated bridges and roads around the country need upgrades, but federal funds have not kept pace with the demand. And that's left the private sector and local governments picking up the slack, even at border crossings. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Jude Joffe Block from the Fronteras Desk reports.
The city of Douglas is in Arizona's southeastern corner, right on the border with Mexico. It's home to about 18,000 people. Cross-border trade and luring in Mexican shoppers are a big part of the local economy. But many say the Douglas border crossing is too small.
As you can see, it's very tight. It's very inefficient. There's no space.
Oscar Vildosola and Carlos Fernandez are business leaders in Douglas. These guys spend a lot of time anxiously waiting for goods to make it through here. And Fernandez says the delays have been getting worse. Traffic is up 30% from 5 years ago.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The line of trucks go on for quite some distance.
The crossing is too narrow, says Vildosola, especially for oversized mining equipment en route to mines south of the border.
In the past, we've had pieces of equipment that don't fit through the door. So we had to hire cranes coming from Tucson or Phoenix and lift those pieces across the fence and set them in Mexico.
Not exactly a vision of efficient 21st century trade. David Murphy is with U.S. Customs and Border Protection's Tucson office.
We have ports of entry around the country like Douglas that are over 70 years old and do not meet the needs of the public in terms of trade or traffic.
But Murphy says there isn't money in the federal budget to keep up with all the needed renovations. So his agency has started a new program that lets outside interests raise money for these upgrades. It's known as the Donation Acceptance Program.
This allows private entities, public entities, or cities to actually come in and partner with us to build or improve facilities.
And this is where the city of Douglas comes in. Its mayor, Danny Ortega, submitted the city's proposal to be one of these partners. His proposal will renovate the current crossing and build an additional commercial crossing just for trucks.
Okay, we're about 5 miles west of Douglas, about a mile.
Ortega and I drive out to see the proposed site for the new truck crossing. It's 80 acres of desert right next to the border fence.
The Mexican landowner just south of us is also willing to donate his land to the federal Mexican government in order to get this port project completed.
Ortega had to get counterparts in the Mexican city of Agua Prieta, plus state governments on both sides of the border, and the Mexican federal government to all agree on the proposal. Ortega believes a new commercial border crossing will create jobs.
It doesn't look like much now, but I'm hoping 2-3 years from now it's going to be a real nice commercial area for Douglas.
But first, the city needs to pay for the port's construction, upwards of $37 million. The city plans to raise the money through bonds and possibly toll revenues or through private investors. It also hopes to convince the federal government to pay rent for the port facility. Robert Puentes with the Brookings Institution says these partnerships are all part of the new reality.
There isn't a lot of money coming from Washington anytime soon. There's really no cavalry coming to help.
Puente says that means creative solutions must be on the table to pay for infrastructure projects, even though border crossings may seem like an unlikely candidate for outsourcing.
Doesn't mean we're not going to do things here in America. We're just going to find different ways to do them.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection has received 7 applications from potential partners for the new donation acceptance program. It will decide by the middle of this year which ones it will accept and whether the Douglas port will be one of them. For Here and Now, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
And Jude's story came to us from the Fronteras Desk, a public radio collaboration in the Southwest that focuses on the border, immigration, and changing demographics.
And this just in from Indiana. Next month, the Republican governor of that state, Mike Pence, plans to launch a new state-sponsored news site called Just In. The Indianapolis Star wrote about Just In earlier this week, describing it as a place for the Pence administration to make pre-written news stories available to Indiana media, as well as sometimes break news about the administration. The backlash from media and other Indiana politicians was immediate. The executive director of the State Press Association called the site an effort by the governor to, quote, control the message. But the governor, who has talked about running for president in 2016, is calling the whole thing a misunderstanding. And today, his communications director held a media briefing to try and clear it up. David Folkenflik is NPR media correspondent. He's been following this story, and he's with us for more on this. David, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much, Jeremy.
And let's start off by just talking about what this service is. What is the idea here?
Well, let's talk about what it appears to be. And news of this was broken not by the state itself, but by the Indianapolis Star's reporter, Tom Lobianco. It was a new site called Just In, I-N, standing for Indiana. It would offer stories with bylines. Those stories would be selected by an editorial board for, among other things, not only the kinds of visual elements they could offer on the site, but also their interest to Hoosier citizens. Those stories would be selected by an editorial board, and the site would be run by a managing editor. And if it seems weird that I'm using some of those titles and jargon, it's because all of those are derived from newsroom lingo and sound very familiar to journalists like you and me. And in fact, this seemed to be conceived of as a state run, that is a government-funded and created news agency that would create stories and send them out. And the idea appears to have been that smaller newspapers around the state could pick up those stories and run them, as well as citizens simply logging on and seeing them for themselves.
And as we said, it has sparked some outrage among the media there. And Governor Pence is pushing back, saying this is a, quote, understandable misunderstanding. Tell us more about what happened today at this news conference.
What a felicitous turn of phrase that is, too. Lobianco tweeted about the news conference live from it, and it seemed to be a wonderful jumble of misunderstandings, down to the question of whether or not it was on the record or off the record, or what the phrase on background meant to a spokesman as opposed to a reporter. It seemed kind of riotous. It seems as though they're walking it back. The governor reached out to an influential political columnist for the Indianapolis Star and said, no, this was just an effort to pull in all kinds of press releases that government agencies and governor's offices typically release, not just in Indianapolis, but throughout state capitals around the country, and that this was just a way of centralizing that. I've got to say that seems very hard to square with the original documents that were obtained and published by the Star. And a lot of reporters are seeing this as not only an end around them, a way of distributing and disseminating information that sort of renders them on the sidelines, but also in a way to an aspiration by the governor's staff to try to plant stories in journalistic outlets that themselves don't originate from journalistic newsrooms. That is, that give it perhaps the patina of journalistic legitimacy, even though they're written by people on the governor's payroll.
Well, what about in Indiana? Has there been a lot of tension between the media and state politicians there and state politics?
Well, it's very interesting. I talked to a longtime state House reporter earlier this morning about that. And she said, you know, that in Indiana, in both parties, governors have tended to be pretty open, that state government has been seen in recent history has been pretty clean, and that there's been decent amount of transparency, good give and take between the governor and reporters, and that Pence himself, while available and accessible, has been more of a talking points administration, a little less substantive in his interactions both, and that staff would tend to respond to requests significantly late enough that it often missed their deadlines by a lot. Pence, though, has an interesting record. You know, after an early foray into politics that wasn't successful about two decades ago, he became a talk radio talk host, and he also became a host of a public affairs show on television there that was actually well-regarded. And in fact, in 2004, he supported legislation to provide protection from reporters who are in the situation of being compelled to provide their sources to law enforcement. A big issue in the Bush administration, as Judy Miller and Matt Cooper and others were pressured to reveal their sources. And additionally, recently received an award from a public television group as being a champion for public broadcasting. And he restored some funding in Indiana budgets for public broadcasting after many years in which it had been removed. So not a guy who's seen as uniformly hostile at all, either to the media or to journalists.
Well, how unusual is it for a state to do something like this? Does this exist in other states, this kind of state-run news service?
Well, it does exist, and you see things in different ways. You see versions of C-SPAN created by state broadcasters that get funding from the state or from other kinds of agencies there. And you also see certain states and certain local agencies trying to provide this. I knew a guy, Joel Sapel, who had been a top investigative editor at the Los Angeles Times, who essentially was tasked by a guy named Zev Yaroslavsky in Los Angeles County with coming up with a local news site there. It was at once trying to get information out to the public. It was trying to cast a friendly light and write features to get people interested in new programs and initiatives. And, you know, as it was explained to me, at times it was supposed to do research for the county supervisor, a fairly influential one there, on what was working and what wasn't working in state government. I wouldn't say that anyone would argue that that replaces what Southern California Public Radio or what the Los Angeles Times does in Southern California, but it was an additional conduit of information. I think the tension here comes over, you know, is it just conveying information to the public, or is this in some ways eroding the press's ability to be a check and a watchdog against government agencies and not simply letting information flow from the public official to the public itself?
Well, how good of a job is the press doing right now on a state level of covering state politics in general around the country?
And in some ways, it's this insecurity that I think has surrounded the press's reaction, even though I think that the reaction itself is probably warranted. And the skepticism, you know, you saw, I think it was the Atlantic magazine called this effort Pravda on the Plains. And that's that because of economic forces pressuring hard against the press, you've seen a major drop in the number of reporters covering state houses. Newspapers, which are the backbone, I think, of state accountability journalism for in the recent past, have cut by more than a third, closer to two-fifths of their reporters. You've seen some new players. The Associated Press, in response to that, has increased it. The Texas Tribune, a not-for-profit, has added a whole new core of reporters. Politico, in some states, has beefed up its reporting. But you're seeing state and government officials moving in to fill some of the vacuum that journalists have not been able to fully fill as they did in the past. And I think that this is contributing to greater fear that there will be not only less accountability, but greater impunity for state officials to push what could amount to propaganda instead of good information.
That's David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. You can let us know where you get your news on a state level at hereandnow.org. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
Southern man in northern land.
It's safe to say that New Englanders have had just about enough of the extremes of Mother Nature around now. But Vermont-born Caitlin Canty can't get enough of the outdoors, from the back roads of Vermont to the summer she spent in a vacant ski lodge in Idaho. Caitlin Canty is a 31-year-old rock, folk, and blues artist who has just released her third album, Reckless Skyline. She came to the studio with musician Mark Irelli as backup, and she said that she writes her songs when she's out in the midst of nature.
Sometimes I'll bring a guitar. I usually am either out going for a hike or I'll bring a notepad. But, I usually don't hike out anywhere with my guitar. I love this guy too much.
All right, which brings us to this guy. This is a Recording King guitar that you have. Maybe you can describe it for us.
Sure. It's from late 30s. I bought it in Boston. A friend had tipped me off. I was looking for a real guitar. And he said I should meet this one. And I wasn't planning on getting an old guitar, but it's got a personality that I couldn't leave it behind. It was like a friend.
You mostly wanted an age-appropriate guitar, but you found there was value in maturity.
Well, I opened it up. It smelled like cigars. It was a blast of smoke that came out with it. And I kept the strings on that were original and dirty and dead. So it's a loud guitar. It sings well with me. I mean, I think that's what a songwriter wants in a singer. You know, you sit down with somebody, and they've got the right vibes, so then you want to keep playing with them, and you write more, and the hours fly.
Good. So. We'll play something else for us on this Recording King guitar with Mark Irelli. This is Caitlin Canty.
Yeah. One, two, three.
get up, get up. No time to rest or run for cover. Get up, get up, get up. Before the road pulls you under. Get up, get up, get up. No time to rest or run for cover. Get up, get up, get up. Before the road pulls you under. Knock the breath out of your madness. Burn your photographs at the edges. Send your heart back from where you left it. Took a long way to come here. Got a long way to go. Walking through tall grass, color of matches on summer's hottest night. Charred bark and dusty ash burned out 2 years back. Dreaming you will find it in the nick of time. Knock the breath out of your madness. Burn your photographs at the edges. Send your heart back from where you left it. Took a long way to come here. Got a long way. Get up, get up, get up. No time to rest or run for cover. Get up, get up, get up. Before the road pulls you under. Get up, get up, get up. No time to rest or run for cover. Get up, get up, get up. Before the road pulls you under.
Caitlin Canty, this album is a live album, so you were in the studio. You were doing it pretty much as you would a live performance if you were at a club.
My experience in studios before making this record was playing my guitar but not singing, singing over the band later on, a month later maybe after you had done the first cut.
And when the band's not even there anymore.
Yeah, and it was like dissecting a beautiful, you know, frog. Maybe not the way to put it, but
being a nature girl, though, I guess.
Yeah,
that is
exactly
the way to put it.
It was unnatural. We are live musicians. We spend all of our time playing live in front of an audience, responding to each other on a stage, and this was to get the live magic, that energy across. It's not to have some auto-tuned monstrosity, which it seems like a lot of digital music goes in that direction.
So is there one song where we can hear kind of the live motion?
I wrote a song in the studio when the tape was rewinding.
You're a best writer. It was a long tape.
I had headphones on, and I just started singing to myself as we were sitting around waiting, and the band kicked in as if on cue. That was My Baby Don't Care. It's, you know, the blues song. But that was just the energy of the band and people communicating with each other in a moment rather than through emails months along the way.
I waited until the morning. I waited until the dawn. Couldn't care at all. Couldn't care at all. Couldn't care at all. Why you gotta let me down? Why you gotta let me down?
You're gonna be moving to Nashville soon.
I am.
So from Vermont to New York, kind of to Boston, mm-hmm. musically anyway, down to Nashville.
That's right.
Why are you making the move? Is it entirely for professional reasons?
Really, it's more a comfortable place to live as a human never mind being a musician. It's an easy place to get around. It makes making music easier because there's more spontaneity. You get a call, can you come sing on this in 5 minutes? And you actually can. In New York, I live 45 minutes from just about everything.
What was it like to be in Idaho?
Well, I think it's in contrast to what I had come from. I had always lived in the Northeast, which I love. And I'd been working for 5 years in cubicle jobs, at computers, in a suit, in a high rise. And I'd been playing music on the side, but I couldn't write well, I couldn't sing well. And I went out west, and it felt more like home to me than home did.
In Idaho.
In Idaho, yeah. And there's a lot of sage-covered hills, and the foothills, they just roll into these sharp, dramatic peaks. I feel strong and healthy out there, so that's one big attraction.
Environment matters to your music and your musicality.
Songs I wrote while in New York City are not songs I want to sing or I want to listen to, or I really don't want anyone to listen to those songs. I like the ones I've been writing when I'm sitting by the Big Lost River or climbing up a pass on Fox Creek, which is where that song Get Up comes from. It's where a wildfire came cruising through and took out about half of the trees on the slope, but it's coming back to life. It's 5 years, 6 years ago that this happened, and it's really beautiful how it's growing back.
Caitlin Canty's brand new album is called Reckless Skylines. She's going to be performing in Chattanooga, Tennessee next week. Find a link to her full schedule at hereandnow.org.
Enough about hard times, you fell on your own knife. Enough about leaving.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.